This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today, I am very excited about presenting Monica Yoon. She's our new Witter-Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress, selected by U.S. Poet Laureate Charles Simic. And here she is in her own voice to set up a poem and tell you about it.
Well, this is a poem about a Norse myth that in the underworld, the dead are building a ship made out of the fingernails of the dead. And the completion of this ship will be one of the signs that the end of the world is at hand. So one thing that apparently the Norse people did was they cut off the fingernails of the dead before burying them to try to delay the onset of the end of the world. So the title of the poem just means Ship of Nails. Naglfar. She said, they are building the ship, the color of steam, the color of salt, the end of the world. She stopped speaking. She was alone. She spent hours cutting her fingernails. They won't take them when I die, she said, for the ridge sides of their ship, cutting off the white crescents. They looked like tiny boats. They collected in her pockets, in the seams of her dress. I am trying, she said, holding out her nailless hands to prevent the end of the world. Ragnarok, she said, if startled, her eyes strayed to the notched petals of the dogwoods, the flecks of mica in the path.
That was Monica Yoon holding out her nailless hands. We could stop the program right there. That is a high point in literature. What do you think made Charlie Simic choose you? What do you think about your poems that he liked?
I think he liked the sharpness of them. I've been told that my poems are a little bit jaggedy, like they're kind of razor cut. And I think that from what I've understood, he likes the way in which I take various angles that are often very sharply inflected.
Well, I can tell you what he said last night. He said, you're hip, you're smart, you've read everything, and so I'm going to take him at his word. And it is true that those who endorse you have a love of the poem with invisible bridges. And Ray, Armand Trout, Claudia Rankine, you're really with the cutting edge of the 21st century, and we're going to hear a lot more about that right here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. This is Monica Yoon, and here she is with a poem.
In terms of the invisible bridges you were talking about, this might be a good one. Letter from Contra Costa. Technically edible, like the nasturtiums, or else softly scoured, or silver-toothed, or shed. Jadi, my dear, the Bart streamed across the bay. 5,000 hosannas, your woodwind spine. In the streets, an air of festival, pumpkin-colored light sifting through the expatriate trees. Already you drifting away from me. Already your face rinsed of detail, the inside of an elbow. Marmoreal, meaning white like marble, or marmoreal, meaning white and hard like marble. I walked for 3 hours. Won't you make the poem Christmas, the answer to everyone's question, Greek fire?
People might say, well, those are disconnected. But in fact, the craft is that they are connected. And would you want to say a word about that? Because I understand the consciousness of that poem. And I think that American poetry is very much leading out of pure narrative, but this is there is a narrative in there. There's a story in there. Can you mention a little bit about that school of thought?
Sure. I would hate to be thought of as completely disjunctive. What I like to think about poetry as a form of choreography for the reader, and I think that it makes it a little more exciting for the reader. I tell my students that you should think of the poem as directions for an ice skater. And, of course, it's always very exciting in an ice skating competition when the skater makes a leap. But it's also only interesting and only skillful if they're able to land that leap. If you make a leap and you completely lose the reader, then it's sort of a pointless exercise. It's just a fall. So the tension and the interest is to see how high you can get the reader to leap without actually falling.
And to make the other side.
Yes, exactly.
How do you know when you've done it?
I think you've done it when you can take the reader through even quite a difficult poem, but still maintain a level of emotional investment so that the reader feels that they have some emotional stake in the poem.
Emotion is there.
Yes.
And I think that that might be part of the hierarchy of the poem. Maybe we could even say that was the bedrock of the poem.
Mm.
And let's hear more so we can investigate this. Monica Yun, and she's reading from Barter. This is a new book, her first book, but not her last, I'm telling you that. And it is Grey Wolf Press. It is actually out this year or last?
No, this was actually out in 2003.
Uh-huh.
So.
And you have one ready to roll, I hear.
I do.
We'll get into that. So let's hear another poem.
Okay, this is also a rather jumpy poem. This is called Fiona Ray. She's a British painter, one of the young British artists that one hears about who was in the, I guess, the Sensation exhibition. Fiona Ray. Thus, a seashell full of breadcrumbs for an eraser. Room at last for the blush of light on a white page. All these illicit Cistercian pleasures. A spiracle, a breathing hole. Remember when you were precious, when you wanted to be impermeable, one among the massed citizens of the mantelpiece. There, bide your time, comb your hair. It's brief, but so easy, warm gold oil drizzled into the willing eye. But always nearby, in fact, nearer now, the thing you won't admit to, the thing with lipstick-colored fur prowling the boxwood corridors.
I guess we could, if we want to examine what makes it work and what the glue is, you are in the center of that landscape. Imagistically, we may not be able to find you all at once, but there is something about your own life that I sense and I taste. And how much do you think of that you have put into your poem?
Well, I think in that last poem, you know, it's not explicitly an autobiographical poem, but there's something in there that is about the experience of beauty and the experience of nostalgia, the way in which physical beauty just wants you to sink into it and to relinquish yourself. But at the bottom of that, there's something, often something darker. There's something that causes one to hold back. There's a fear. And I guess the poem starts with this experience of beauty and comfort, and then it moves to this something a little bit ominous, this thing with lipstick-colored fur prowling the boxwood corridors. That's, you know, that's a bit of a childhood.
Pretty scary.
It's a nightmare image.
And also, but the word precious
mm-hmm.
is very important in that poem. I can't think of a better word that is kind of an ultra word. You know, it's not pretty, it's not sweet, it's not beautiful. Precious is borderline clinical beauty. And the longing for that.
Exactly. Well, I think the key line in that poem is, remember when you were precious. It has this idea of being cherished, being placed on the mantelpiece, as is put forward in that poem. There's something about childhood, there's something about innocence and nostalgia there.
All there.
Mm-hmm.
All there.
But then that's something that you just don't feel safe really relaxing into.
Mm. This is who she is. She's a woman who was raised in Houston. She's now an attorney at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law and an adjunct assistant professor of creative writing at Columbia University. She is the author of Barter, and her poems have been in wonderful magazines, Paris Review and many others. She's been in the Norton Anthology, Language for a New Century, and she has a bachelor's degree from Princeton, a master's of philosophy from Oxford, and a law degree from Yale. She's received the Rhodes Scholarship and the Wallace Stegner Fellowship in Poetry at Stanford. I wish you could have gotten educated. Really,
yes.
What have you been doing with your life? It's pathetic. Well, maybe you've redeemed yourself with poetry. So here she is, Monica Yun.
Fort Tryon Park. Itch of squirrels in the dry leaves. Should I have worn my warmer coat? mortared and bordered, switchbacks and oxbows, how one's descents must be measured, how I once woke to find all physical courage gone. The blind white wipe of Hudson, the GW Bridge suspension towers, slats of sunset light, call to mind my Helena's wired jaw when she spent winter sipping sustenance through a flattened pink straw.
Mm-hmm. Keep going. I'm formulating some thinking about this.
Okay. This is another painter poem. This is called After Franz Klein. In what box is it buried, that first fossilized dawn? What thing in me survived the sight of you nosing through the bedsheets for each shed strand of my black hair before 10 years my elder Allison got home?
That's one of my favorites. I love that ending. Read us that last line again.
Before 10 years my elder Allison got home.
What a good thing. 10 years my elder Allison.
Well, this is a poem that's very much based, you know, it's a poem that's taken after a painting, and people are always like, what does that have to do with Franz Klein? Because if you know Franz Klein's work, he's one of the classic abstract expressionists. He does these kind of almost dimensional structures out of brushstrokes. And this was a particular painting that had 5 brushstrokes and a very strong diagonal. And so what I was interested, and the brushstrokes almost, the shape that they were making almost looked like a casket, something that was prehistoric or Neolithic, some sort of structure like that. And I wanted to write a poem about memory and the way that things get buried. And I wanted the poem to mimic in structure the structure of the painting. The 5 brushstrokes would turn into 5 lines. And then there would be this sort of diagonal sound rhyme that kind of pulls the poem together on a diagonal axis.
We talked about what aspects of yourself are encompassed in the poem. So would there be something we could find there about that? Only perhaps your sensibility?
Yeah, I think that...
Your reaction to art, maybe.
Yeah, this is a poem about an experience that, of course, was very traumatic at the time. Hmm. This was, you know, being in love with someone and then realizing that that person who I was in love with was being unfaithful, you know, in that experience. When I was very young, that experience...
How nice that you didn't write the poem, I was in love with someone and he was unfaithful. That has been done.
Yes.
I'm so glad you departed, because Charlie Simic said, you are unpredictable.
But I was thinking about what happens when you take a traumatic memory like that and then you, I guess, bury it. The first line of the poem is, in what box is it buried? Mm. And then you unearth it later to write a poem about it, and you find just kind of the bones of this memory, just this, the way in which memory becomes formal, just because all of the surface, all of the texture gets taken away by age. And what you have is this kind of skeletal thing of what used to be a traumatic memory. This is very much what this poem is about.
I'm giving you an assignment. You are going to write an essay, a book of essays about your process, because I do think it's something that would be a contribution.
Okay.
And I love that, using that poem, just the way you dissected it. I think it would be a nice thing for you to do after teaching, after working, after doing all your copyright laws.
Mm-hmm.
3 o'clock in the morning, you know. But I do think you'd be very good articulating your process. You agree?
Yeah, I hope so. I'm always going off to my students about this sort of thing.
So write it down.
And they seem to like it.
Well, if you read the whole book, what do you think it's leading toward?
This first book, Barter, is really about a form trying to escape from itself.
There's the title of your book of essays.
Yeah, in a way that, for example, if you think about Elizabeth Bishop's One Art and the way in which the form there, which is a very strict form, that poem is entirely about the tension of emotion and form and the way in which the mind tries to assert control over the emotions by forcing them into form. Form is something that's controllable. It's something that's modular and something that you can come to terms with. And emotion, of course, is not. And this book was very much about, how do you take emotion and turn it into form? How do you And does that allow you control over your emotions? Does that, or does that cause some sort of what would almost be a pathology?
Did you have that which generated the writing, or is that something which is easier found after you've written it, that concept?
I think the concept was there as I started to think about these poems as a book. For example, the word barter, which is the title of the collection, is not in any of the poems. It was originally in this poem that I then subsequently took out of the manuscript. But I think that the term barter is about what is lost when one takes sensation and emotion and experience and exchanges that for art. You know, an artistic thing is an artifact. It's an object. And there's a way in which making this object, there's something that gets taken away. I was always very interested in the process of lost wax casting, for example.
Yes, and the discarding.
Exactly, and what gets discarded, what gets taken away, and why we have this, why we are compelled to enter into this art-making process to try to take experience and to try to make an artifact out of it.
Just I can just tell how Claudia Rankin loves you. Have you met her?
I adore Claudia.
Oh, I do too, but you are just, I can just say that she must say, this is reason enough to be alive. You substantiate all her hopes.
I think her daughter pretty much does that.
Oh, yes.
But Claudia is one of the smartest and most brilliant and most beautiful poets writing today.
Forming consciousness as you write consciousness and describing it as you define it is pretty cool, though. Let's have a handful of poems, and then we'll see what else we come up with.
Okay.
This is Monica Yun. The book is Barter. We're at the Library of Congress because she's the new Witter Binner Fellow for this year, chosen by Charlie Simic.
Electronica. Felix the Rat's hind feet could be Barbie hands. Same pink, same injection molded seeming. Asleep in daylight, his tail still disconcerts. Hairless, like that quatrefoil we found online. A woman part penetrated, front and back, a span of inches. Someone's vision of achieved grace, I suppose. Barbiturates and a macro lens. Meanwhile, the kettle ramps up to a boil. Stops short, starts over. Four spaced clicks, the gas ignites, looped and digitized. Graphed on screen, each sound wave worships its neighbors, seeks its grip on the rhythmic grid, and must be coaxed loose or looser. Reverse quantization, you explain. To love the world, to set soft baffles in the path of the automatic architectural, every light that walks into this room.
Cultural statement.
Definitely. This is a poem that's very much about this function, the software function that's described in the poem, reverse quantization. These friends of mine who this poem is dedicated to are electronic musicians, and what they do is they take field recordings of various sounds. In fact, they at one point took a field recording of my laser eye surgery, my LASIK, and made that into a song. And they're very well known for doing this. But what I found fascinating watching them work is they will take these sounds and then they'll feed them into their software and they'll kind of sculpt out these beats and rhythms and these loops, etc. And then what they'll get out of that is often a little inhuman sounding. It's a little too perfect. Mm. These repetitions are too perfect. Mm. And so they will put it into this process called reverse quantization, which is something that it adds in a human factor. What it does is it puts in some some random variables. So what had been very looped and mechanical sounding starts to sound human again, but only by virtue of this this software function.
By inhuman functions.
Exactly, which I thought was hilarious. But, you know, I also thought that their work is very much about loving the world, about taking the texture of the world and making it into music. But in doing so, they have to go through this strange backwards process of taking something human, making it inhuman, and then reinserting the human into the human.
Sounds like we're doing it all the time.
Yes.
But the pink feet that could be Barbie hands mm-hmm. were disturbing, a little disturbing. Did you wish for that to be disturbing?
Oh, yeah. I think I intended for that to be disturbing.
And the uncontrollable twitching of the tail, mm-hmm. which is that variable, I guess. But you do mention love.
Mm-hmm.
And there is love in your book.
Yes.
There is a lot of... Is creativity love for you?
I think, yes, it's definitely a kind of love. I mean, you love the world, and thus you want to make art about it. And, you know, I'm always feeling this guilt about reality, the texture of reality and experience, and I'm always...
Only a poet would feel guilt about the texture of reality.
But, you know, it's the sort of thing where you feel like you should stop imposing your imagination on everything, and all you should do yeah. is you should go out with a notebook and write down everything you see. There's this Hugh Kenner, who is one of my favorite literary critics, has this sentence which I've always loved, which is idiosyncrasy of language derives from attention, which is to say that what happens in reality is so much more surprising and interesting than anything that can happen in your mind. Because what is happening in your mind is always connected. My friends and I, when we were very dorky, used to play this non sequitur game, and this is something that I occasionally will assign to my students, which is to try to come up with some sequence that is so disparate that the human mind can't connect it. And you can't do it, because there's always a way in which your mind can connect two things. What you come up with in your mind is always, I think of, in one of the poems in my new manuscript, I refer to the imagination as an elastic room, because you're always being pulled back into your own thought processes, and you can't escape very far beyond that. So I think the only way to do that is to immerse yourself in what is real and what is actual.
Everything is connected,
mm-hmm.
whether we like it or not.
Yes.
I really love that exercise where you try to find a non sequitur.
Yes.
And it's impossible to unconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep going. Monica Yoon, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and it's a pretty exciting hour.
Here's a very short poem. Kestrel etymology. A groom, a varlet, one pressed into use, a gymnast trembling in his iron cross.
I read that at 5 o'clock this morning, and I saw it.
Well,
I saw the same thing.
I remember I was at Point Reyes, and there are these kestrels, these, I guess they're the same birds that Hopkins called the windhover. And they're amazing because they can just literally sit there on the edge of a cliff or above the edge of a cliff, and they look as if they are completely unmoving because they are, I guess, reading the air current so at such a minuscule level that you can't detect any motion, and they're just hovering there. And they're these dark birds, and with their wings outspread, you know, and their little dark bodies, they look like crosses in the sky. And so I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about these gymnasts who are these male gymnasts who are in this position called the Iron Cross, which is where they're hanging from two rings with their arms outstretched, and I guess they're graded on how still they can maintain this very untenable position. And so this poem is very much about the discomfort of remaining in a form. This is a two-line poem, and it's what my friend Steve Burt calls a chiastic poem. It's a in the shape of a cross, because the first foot rhymes of the first line rhymes with the second foot, with the first foot of the second line, and then the groom, Jim, and then the two end words rhyme,
read
use
that
and
again.
Cross.
Read that again.
A groom, a varlet, one pressed into use, a gymnast trembling in his iron cross. So the rhyme structure of the poem creates a cross, which is meant to be a little bit uncomfortable. This poem is supposed to feel too short, overcompressed, just a little bit uncomfortable in the way that you think of this poor gymnast hovering there. But this is a poem I looked up kestrel because I didn't know what it meant in my OED. And it comes from apparently an old French word that means groom or varlet, which I thought was just a fascinating etymology for this word. 103 Korean Martyrs. Where was it that we went that night? That long, low building, floodlights rimmed in lavender, the moon ringed in rose. I would rather, then, have stayed outside, where spiderwebs glowed like jellyfish in the damp yew hedges, where the paths were chalky pebbles set with giant stepping stones. But the film was starting. In the air-conditioned dark, a crowd of strangers, strange families, not from our church, in rows of metal folding chairs to see a man quartered by horses, strain stitched across his shining back, then, all over at once, an unraveling, and then the spill of meat. A girl pushed through a doorway, naked among the soldiers. She grew a dress to cover herself, a blue dress with a blinding sash.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are talking to Monica Yuen, who is the author of Barter. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back. We're back now at the Library of Congress, and Monica Yuen is here with us. She's the new Witterbinner Fellow, chosen by Charles Simic, and he calls her unpredictable, surprising, witty, sharp, and smart. And those are good things. Now, if you were to read a book of poetry, when you pick up a book of poetry, I'm sure you read a book a day. I mean, most people who write poetry read more poems than they write. What is your instantaneous reaction to a poem? Do you say, this is not for me, this is not my cup of tea, or do you go for the guts? What instantaneously happens to you when you look at the page?
I think I try to get a sense of whether the poem is gelling, I think, is the easiest way I have of explaining my reaction. And in many ways, I'm a very bad reader of poetry. Like, I like specific kinds of poems which are to my taste.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognize the validity of other forms of poems, and I love them. For example, Paradise Lost is something that I, as a poet, I don't approach it as a poem. As a reader, I approach it as something that I love very dearly. But it's just not something that immediately, as a poet, says, okay, here's something that I can add to my toolbox. Here's something that causes me to think about, you know, that really gets my poet juices flowing, I suppose is one horrible way to put it.
Well, so I think then many poets want to learn. As they read, they're thinking, what can I appropriate in a way? You know, what's like me? In fact, I think Charles Simic chose you because he saw a little of himself in you.
I think that all poets, you know, you write the way you do for a reason. And you write the way you do because it's a way that particularly appeals to you. It's impossible to be completely democratic as an artist and completely even-handed.
But we couldn't write the way you do in 1934.
I think you could, actually.
Who did, though? I mean, I'm thinking of all the poets that have even tried to get close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's evolutionary.
I agree that it is evolutionary, but I think that there are people who have been writing in certain ways for a while. In 1934, I mean, Pound...
I just chose that.
...would have been... You know, Pound is somebody who I've always thought of as very important to me. Of course, Dickinson, Loreen Nydecker. I may be getting my dates wrong, but...
I can see Pound.
And in fact, I think that the group of poems that were most formative to me in writing were Rilke's new poems of 1907 and 1908.
Is that right? Tell me why.
Well, Rilke has this idea of the thing poem. That was a time in which he was working very closely with Auguste Rodin, and he was trying to come up with a way in which, I guess he was thinking a lot about sculpture, and his poems the 1907-1908 new poems, most famously Archaic Torso of Apollo, maybe, are poems that function in a way that is sculptural. If you think about the poem Archaic Torso of Apollo, there's this, of course, this torso, and you can see this poem very clearly in terms of camera angles. It's as if you took a camera and you're doing an extreme close-up of this torso, and you can not only see the angle, but you can see the way in which it's walking around the space, so that you're getting drawn into this kind of spiral of attention.
That's good.
In the poem, and then suddenly you're pulled out of it with the very famous, "For there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life."
So you think that perspective and geography were really the progenitors of your kind of poetry in a way?
I think so. Or just the way, the book Barter is very much about other forms of art.
Yes.
And I've always found them very helpful in thinking about poetry. And I think that this poem, Archaic Torso of Apollo, is famous for a reason in that...
I think his assistant probably did the sculpture, though.
Exactly.
But Dan's assistant.
Yeah, but I think that in terms of walking, in terms of creating that leap and creating the setup for that leap,
that leap
at the end would not have worked had you not been so carefully drawn into the surface, the light playing over the surface, the details of this, which enables you to get that sort of pathway, that momentum, which causes you to be able to be that startled, but also that which enables you to be pulled along into that leap as opposed to the leap just leaving you behind.
That's good. Yes. So that's the angular approach. And we will hear more of you and see where you're going. This is Monica Yuen. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're hearing a little bit more of Barter, and then we're going to go to new material. Which do you like best in this book? Which poem?
Oh, which poem do I like best in this book? I think I probably like the first poem the best. And then some of the poems toward the end. I'm fond of this poem, Flowerbed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange little poem. It's also a poem based on mythology. This is a retelling of the Persephone myth. Flowerbed. Consummately demure white bouquets of alyssum. Are they sufficiently the irresistible flower of my story? Dig a hole with your hands. She will live there. With a wax paper roof, she will thrive there. And a pine needle bed, she'll behave there. Block the entrance with dirt, she won't leave there.
Did you attribute that to Persephone?
I can't remember whether I mentioned that in the notes or not.
Oh, I see. Yes, you did. Uh-huh.
Oh, I think I actually didn't, because my editor complained that the notes were...
Your notes were interesting.
We're taking over the book.
Longer than the book.
Mm-hmm.
However, does it bother you that we may not make that connection?
Oh, not particularly, no. I think...
It was enough for you to do it.
Yeah, there's a difference between the scaffolding for the poem and the poem itself. And I'm not sure with that particular poem whether the myth is acting as the scaffolding that enabled you to write it, or whether it's part of the poem itself. I think it's more like the scaffolding. The poem with, for example, the Naglfar poem that I read first, The Ship of Nails, it's essential that you know the myth in order to understand the poem, but I don't know that that's true for the Flowerbed poem.
Read the last four lines again.
Flowerbed?
Yes.
Dig a hole with your hands, she will live there. With a wax paper roof, she will thrive there. And a pine needle bed, she'll behave there. Block the entrance with dirt, she won't leave there.
It was the lyricism that I wanted to hear again, and the music. And that certainly ends with a beautiful drifting. And using the words "there" four times is perfect there, I think.
Yeah, there's also 4 degrees of slant rhyme in live, thrive, behave, and leave in the penultimate syllable.
Mm-hmm. Good. Monica Yuen, we're at the Library of Congress, and we're talking about what's intuitive and what's cognitive and how they come together and what they really mean. And does the intuitive... Well, tell me what you think intuitive means and what cognitive means.
I think that... I don't know if I really know the difference between those terms. I think that there is a way of apprehending a kind of resonance between two things that is very difficult to articulate, other than putting those two things in a poem. And your faith is that the reader is also going to pick up on that resonance and is not going to think that you're crazy for putting those things together. One of my first professors Paul Muldoon once said something that was sort of like, I think I probably expanded on his definition of this, but, you know, a poem can just exist in the juxtaposition of two things. Because if you think of two things, this would be like a physics experiment in high school. If you think of you put two things in two different trays of water and they're both setting off their same, their little resonance patterns in that water, the ripples that you can see, and then you put those two things closer together, you can see, there's a pattern that emerges out of the interference pattern of those two resonances, and that interference pattern is one way of thinking about what a poem is, what it can do.
Where did he teach you?
Oh, this was at Princeton.
Oh, he was at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And have you seen him since he's taken over the New Yorker?
I don't know that I've seen him since he's taken over the New Yorker. I see him fairly often. I try to go to any reading of his that I can get to in New York. So.
You like his work?
Oh, I adore his work. Mm. So,
Monica Yoon, we're going to adore some more of your work.
Okay. Here's a short one. Doe, in headlights in the Marin headlands, hind legs lit for an instant, tapering, taupe, on tiptoe, the half-mannequin hosiery display at Dillard's I could watch for hours, hidden in a toroid rack of satin half-slips, hoarding price tags I thought were receipts.
Perfect for barter.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do that. Another one here. Is there something you love in that book you wouldn't want to miss?
I think we've pretty much gone through the...
The ones without dirty words.
The ones without dirty words mm-hmm. that I...
However, the ones with are really worth hearing, but...
Actually, I do love this little poem, Ending.
Yes.
Ending. Fresh water stunned the beaches. I could sleep.
Now tell us, we're going to shift gears, and you're going to tell us about this new tangent you're on with your new manuscript and what's behind your writing there. Monica Yoon is... I don't know if it's ready for publication or if it's been offered to a publisher yet, or if you're still in the process?
I'm shopping it right now. I relatively recently completed the manuscript, and I'm still fiddling, but I'm shopping it as I'm
When you
I'm
say
fiddling.
Shopping it, tell me exactly what that means.
It means that you send it out to various places. Sometimes you know the people, sometimes you don't know the people, and you're sending it cold.
How long do you think it will take before it gets noticed?
Oh, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you believe in contests?
Oh, yeah, I definitely believe in contests. I think that as a second book, there may be fewer contests open to it than there would be to a first book.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That is, in fact, I'm not even sure that's fair anymore.
I think it makes
sense. There's a great proportion. Most contests are for first books now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's a question of fairness. I think it's certainly easier for me as a second book writer to write directly to a press and say, hey, how about this, than it would be for a first book writer.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, the first book writer, they would just go right into the slush pile. And
but competitions at least are read.
Mm-hmm.
And I just judged the National Poetry Contest last month, and the woman who won died before she got the announcement. She was 94.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I didn't know who she was,
mm-hmm.
and her kin were very happy. I mean, she died one day, and the announcement came the next.
Oh no!
And
it's terrible.
They cherished it, but it's not funny. But it's wonderful
that
she was writing at 94, and the poem. I had no idea it could have been by a 19-year-old.
Yes.
Now that's the good thing about poetry.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Now let's hear the good thing about your new manuscript.
Well, the new manuscript is a very strange little idea that I had that's expanded into a full book. It's based on the Crazy Cat comic strip by George Harriman, which comic strip people know is one of the all-time classic comic strips. And it was published between, I think, 1914 and 1944. So for a good 30 years, this thing existed as a daily strip, kind of like Peanuts. And the plot of the comic strip is that there is a cat named Crazy, and it's always kind of unclear what gender Crazy is, but I refer to Crazy as a she for convenience sake. And then there is a mouse called Ignatz, and Crazy is in love with Ignatz. And Ignatz is really kind of a mean little mouse, a little bit criminal, and he likes to throw bricks at Crazy, which hit Crazy in the head. And Crazy, being Crazy, takes the bricks as tokens of reciprocated affection. And this whole kind of insane slapstick cycle just keeps going on strip after strip. Almost every strip has cat, mouse, brick, love. And I thought that just the modularity of this is fascinating. I mean, comic books are very interesting because they contain character and they in some ways contain emotional valence, but they are static rather than dynamic. No one ever dies. No one ever gets married. No one ever grows any older.
What do you make of people reading the same thing over every day, though?
I know. It's fascinating to me that people would just continue to read cat, mouse, brick, love, and that there's this sort of expectation that gets set up where you're waiting for the brick to make its appearance in a particular strip. And you kind of know what's going to happen. You know how it's going to end. And yet you still keep reading. And you know that the characters are never going to change. You know that Ignatz is never going to love Crazy. You know that Crazy is never going to fall out of love with Ignatz.
Don't tell us that because our audience may have expectations. And if you read a couple poems, we'll get all fired up for this. The title is?
The title is Ignatz, or the title of the entire book is Ignatz. And it's,
why did you take that point of view?
I think I wanted to, there's a way in which you can, you know, Wallace Stevens has 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And I thought, okay, one thing that a comic strip does is it takes the same character and it just keeps looking at them. And you can take the same character and suddenly you'll be on the deck of a pirate ship and the characters will be enacting their little codependent cycle on the deck of a pirate ship. Or suddenly they'll all be in ancient Egypt. Or suddenly they'll be in, you know, Elizabethan England.
Hmm.
And I thought that it was just kind of fascinating to have this character just looked at from a number of angles. And I thought that that has something to do with what certain kinds of obsessive love do, which is you set the character as the hero of a variety of stories and you put them against various backgrounds.
And since all love is obsessive, your manuscript's going to be for everyone.
Exactly.
Give us a poem or two.
Okay. This one is called Letter to Ignatz, and in the first line, the word devoir in French means something like a duty, I suppose. Letter to Ignatz. Oh, my dear devoir, oh, my dour devour, your name, an arrow with a rope attached, could pull this raft across this river. Oh, bring me my ordinary, my trays of soot and sand, for tonight I am a window in a cottage by the sea. Oh, mia paloma blanca, oh, my desert dune, my dove, who now will sing the praises of a natural love?
Take us further and farther.
So this is a poem that quotes Crazy Cat in some ways. Crazy is always singing a little song, I'm a window in a cottage by the sea. And the strip itself is set in the desert, in the Arizona desert, which in a lot of ways the book, I had a lot of fun playing with landscape in this book.
And was Harriman from that area?
Yeah, Harriman was, I don't know if he was originally from that area. He was Creole by background, and often in the strip, the characters speak a sort of patois, which is very hard to replicate. I tried it with one poem in the book. I'm not sure how successful that was, but
it's a nice touch. It's a nice touch.
But generally, I just try to stay in plain or relatively plain English for the book. Here's a little, this is the first poem in the book, and it's a little introduction to Ignatz. Ignatz invoked. A gauze bandage wraps the land and is unwound, stained orange with sulfates. A series of slaps molds a mountain. A fear uncoils itself, testing its long, cool limbs. A passing cloud seizes up like a carburetor and falls to earth, lies broken-backed and lidless in the scree. Acetylene torches now snug in their holsters, shotbacks trundled back behind the dawn. A mist becomes a murmur, becomes a moan, rising from dust-choked fissures in the rocks. Oh, piteous Ignatz, oh, come to us by moonlight. Oh, arch your speckled body over the earth.
Ignatz becomes beautiful. This is not right. This is impossible. Let's go on.
Here's a little love poem that's also near the beginning of the book.
Oh, by the way, that was in couplets. Any special reason?
No, I think that I don't generally have a theory of why things are in couplets.
But it was extremely musical. And so I think that had something to do with it.
I think so. I mean, I try to just have the form. There's always this which comes first, form or content. And honestly, it's just kind of a wrestling match all the way through. You're kind of playing with things. You're putting them in different stanza forms and taking them out. You're just constantly reworking the lines to see what is best going to leverage the particular corners of that poem.
Mm.
So this one is a little love poem called Ignatz Obad. Star maps of broken capillaries, crown of infrared, song of drifting dune, the smooth, bold trees of his interior, blossoming and unblossoming. I spent 6 days almost touching you.
Mm.
And so both of those poems have quite a bit of landscape going on in them. There's this idea of the desert and the desert infusing things. The first poem, the Ignatz Invoked poem, is, I guess I was always visiting a friend of mine who lived in Tucson, and Tucson is kind of the heart of a kind of spa culture. And I would take advantage of that, and so I'd go and visit my friend, and we would go on these kind of fasting rituals where you would be walking in the desert and sweating out all your toxins, and very purifying. And there was a way in which, in that first poem, Ignatz Invoked, the landscape has become over-purified. It has been wrapped in bandages, it has been shop-vacked, the atmosphere has gotten a little too thin, and the land feels itself kind of unprotected, a little bit sterile. And so Ignatz is the kind of contaminant in that landscape that the landscape, having been over-purified, is now wishing for. This is a funny little poem. This is a villanelle, and there's a tradition in some Asian cultures, I think, where there's a figure called the panegyrist who is the person whose job it is to constantly be singing the praises of the emperor. And so this person would be, in any procession, would be walking backwards in front of the emperor, constantly singing the emperor's praises, which if I were the emperor, I would, I think, get a little bored of, but the...
Or would you not believe it after a while?
I don't know how much you would really believe it, but, you know, so usually you see these lovely pictures of these processions where the panegyrist has a parasol and the emperor has a parasol and everyone is walking backwards except for the emperor, and there's a lot of pomp and state. And this little villanelle, I've always thought of a villanelle as kind of this insane clockwork form. And so I was thinking of reenacting the Crazy Cat and Ignatz love story in miniature, and was thinking of these as little figures that go around a cuckoo clock, which the villanelle form seemed particularly suited to. Ignatz, A Desert Waltz. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings of Ignatz, blackguard, bandit, and bane. In flies betrayal on ultra-suede wings. His target selected, so feckless, he flings a lethal love missile with unerring aim. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. A Rube Goldberg contraption of widgets and springs makes mechanical love, no volition, no blame. In flies betrayal on ultra-suede wings. In Coconino Cathedral, a silver bell rings. Robed in white cambric, his love waits in vain. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. She fled to the desert. In her wanderings, she dreamt that you summoned the life-giving rain. In flies betrayal on ultra-suede wings. The lithium waters of Sahuaro Springs, no amour analgesic, no solvent for shame. The panegyrist beneath a parasol sings. In flies betrayal on ultra-suede wings.
I believe that villanelle helps that poem a lot.
Yeah, I think I really tried not to write the poem as a villanelle. I tried writing this poem
But the
as...
ritual mm-hmm. is important.
Yes.
The rite and the ritual is externalized.
Yeah.
So I think that helped a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Yeats has this quotation, which I've always loved, which is, how else but in custom and ceremony are innocence and beauty born? Which I think
beautiful.
Is just lovely, which has nothing to do with the villanelle in that poem, but well, which I just wanted to quote.
Ultra suede wings, ultra suede wings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, you know, I had, that was very much a poem as a stage setting. And
makes sense.
And so it was kind of fun to think about how you would have
costume it.
Exactly, how you would costume it. This is another poem as a stage setting. It's a kind of Disneyland concept. Like, what if you had Ignatz and Crazy Cat as a theme park? Ersatz Ignatz. The clockwork saguaros sprout extra faces like planaria stroked by a razor. Chug, say the sparrows, emitting fluffs of steam. Chug, chug, say the piston-powered ground squirrels. The tumbleweeds circle on retrofitted tracks, but the blue pasteboard welkin is much dented by little winds. The yuccas pulse softly under the grow light sconces. Here is the door he will paint on the rock. Here is the glass floor of the cliff. He'll appear in the west, backlit by orange isinglass, pyrite pendants glinting from the fringes of his voice. That's very much a Wile E. Coyote sort of poem, you know, those wonderful cartoon special effects that one gets.
I am in love. Go ahead.
There was a wedding scene in the villanelle that I read, and this is the kind of more extended version of the wedding scene. The wedding of Ignatz. Wait is the end of wanting. The simples gleaming in their rests. In the game called hypothesis, an orange is gripped between the chin and shoulder, then is transferred with care and laughing to the chin and shoulder of the next in line. Then a flaming log is rolled into the river. Then a chalk circle is drawn around each plate. One day I walked to the window, robed in the loveliest robe of the year. One day I knelt down by the fountain, a crown of parsley, a crown of dill. One day my hands closed on the handles, a match tip was placed beneath my tongue. Listen to me, someone has tricked you. There never was an apple.
Did you want to dignify them? I mean, the graphic arts is such a reductionist kind of thing. Did you want to give an interior life to that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the nice thing about this particular format for the book is you can kind of draw back and do a sort of cartoon, you know, wide scale, but you can also very much go inside, go to the interior. And there are some parts of the book that become very, very dark because, you know, the love story itself is portrayed in a very cartoonish way in comedy, but comedy, people will tell you, always has a dark side. There's something very cruel about what is comic, and I think that being able to explore that aspect of cruelty, both straight and slant, was one of the reasons I was drawn to this particular format for the book.
And it's tragedy is failed comedy,
yeah, exactly.
We always say, and so are human relationships.
Mm-hmm. There's a very...
Or mouse-cat relationships.
Exactly. This is a rather strange poem. Crazy is always referring to Ignatz as little angel. And there are a lot of little thought bubbles in the comic strip in which Ignatz is figured as a little angel with little wings sprouting from his shoulder blades. But there is, of course, a very much darker side.
Are you going to be able to get the rights for some of the visuals, do you think, for the cover?
I don't know that I would actually want to have
the
visuals as the cover because... The comic strip is a jumping-off place for the book, but the book doesn't really track the comic strip.
No, it doesn't.
And,
I've
gotten a couple people have said, well, this doesn't sound very much like Harriman, you know, or this isn't really faithful. And I don't want to really, this is not a comics nerd squad book. It's more like, you know, it is very loosely inspired and based on the poems and kind of on the comic strip and the idea for the comic strip, but it's certainly not supposed to be a translation or whatever of the comic strip.
Well, this will be our final poem, so would you choose one that you want to leave with us?
Yeah, here's one that shows that I was starting to set up, which is about Ignatz and Wings, which is a darker poem. Winged Ignatz. There are 27 feathers. There are 15 feathers on the right shoulder blade, 12 on the left, curving outward, then streaming down the back. When I say feathers, I mean to say lines. Undulating lines, more like hair than like feathers, since, unlike feathers, these lines do not convey a ruched or corrugated effect, as might be rendered by layered tiers of scallops or by a fingered edge. Instead of lines, I might more precisely have said cuts, discontinuous cuts dotted with blood clots. Flinches cluster at the clots like mayflies as one imagines the blade snagging in the skin where the cuts cross one another. Mayflies, too, are winged, but no one wants them unless to convey a sense of the ephemeral, a fan of surface scratches that splay across the shoulders but do not break the skin, merely exhortatory, inviting one to read the underlying cuts as dimensional, on the verge of lifting out of the skin, unfurling above the shoulders, lines of blood fleshing themselves, then feathering themselves, in strength and mass rivaling the body, muscle-bound, that submitted to give them birth.
The voice of Monica Yun. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. We wish to thank the Witter Binner Foundation for funding this series and the WordWorks presenting poetry programs in Washington, D.C. since 1975. And we thank the Library of Congress for its assistance and support. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.